This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation, please visit our website at zmm.mro.org/donate. Thanks for your support.
Good morning, everyone. And good morning to those of you who are at home or wherever you might be. So this is the end of our first session of the Sangha. And as most of you know, we normally end the sessions with a Dharma encounter. And I thought, given our circumstances and the fact that so many students and Sangha members are joining us from elsewhere, from their own places, and that it would be hard to have them have you join in with a Dharma encounter, I thought instead we would do a mando. And so what I'd like to do is center it around the Metta Sutta, the teachings on loving kindness from the Buddha. And so to begin, let's just sit for just a couple minutes, and then we'll chant this together and encourage you folks at home to chant along with us. And then we'll, from there, go on into the mando.
Or strong, forsaking none the grace.
I wanted to say a few things to get started, but the way we wanted to do this was that we'll sort of alternate between questions or comments from residents here and then those of you who are where you are. And so you can just send in those notes in the way that I hope you know how to. and Shoan will receive them and read them. And we'll just alternate. What I'd like to do is, really bring up anything that is relevant in terms of your practice. We're concluding a week of Sesshin, the time that we're in, and this teaching, which is ancient and so contemporary. And in particular, how does it speak to us? How does it speak to you in terms of both giving us guidance, teachings, in how to bring forth loving kindness and compassion within ourselves, particularly now, and in the Buddha's presentation or pointing to certain qualities, virtues, ways of using our mind, what are the other sides of those? In other words, when we see things that are not what he's presenting, but the other sides of those. And when we see those both within ourselves and in others. Because this is a time in which perhaps more than usual, we will see the spectrum of human nature coming forth. And so how do we bring forth loving kindness and extend it to ourselves and others, given all of the various ways in which we and others may be displaying ourselves. Many years ago, Daroshi came to myself, Myotai Sensei, and asked us to put together a few retreats that would be the basis for training students in receiving the precepts. Up to that point, it was really just something that a student brought to Daroshi and expressed interest and worked it out with him directly, and then they would, at some point, enter into the week of precepts training. And so he wanted to do more training, more preparation, more teachings to help prepare students for that, for taking vows. And so she and I worked, he gave us some basic outlines, but she and I worked independently and basically put together our own outline for how we were going to handle those various retreats that we have put together and we utilize. And not having been raised in a religious home, but raised within a morality, but didn't, it wasn't connected to a particular teaching or tradition. There was no precepts, no specific set of rules. It was just it was just imparted to us often when we weren't doing so good. When we were getting into mischief, and they were trying to get us back on an even track. And so in trying to work out these retreats, I had to really think deeply, even though I had received the precepts and had come close to or had finished my training, I now had to look at them in a whole nother way in order to offer them. And so I really started at the beginning, which I needed to do for myself. And so I thought, well, before even getting into Buddhism or Buddha Dharma or precepts, if there is a set of moral teachings that is trustworthy, what makes them trustworthy? And this was like just a thought experiment of my own, a thought process to try and get into them in a way that was from the inside out. And I'm bringing this up because I think it's true not just of the precepts, but of the Dharma, of teachings and practice. And so, and this is in no way definitive, it's just what I sort of came to on my own. But what I thought was that first, that those teachings, this teaching, has to be based in truth. It has to be true. Otherwise, obviously, it's not true. And then how could that possibly help us? And to be true means that it has to be based in the real nature of things. Prajna, the nature of reality, wisdom. And it has to, the teachings and the practices have to be perfectly in accord with how things actually are in reality. And in that sense, they have to be timeless and universal, because they can't be subject to change in the sense that if you go to a different country, there's a whole new set of moral teachings, right? Or a whole new dharma. That wouldn't work. Or if what was true for our teachers was not true for us because we live in the next generation, that also wouldn't work. So it had to be timeless, free of time and place. And at the same time, completely applicable and true in this time and place. Otherwise, we can't use them. I thought they would need to acknowledge, understand, and embrace all of what it means to be a human being. From the very best that we can be to the very worst that we can be. In other words, they can't exclude any of that because that all exists within us. And in our lives and practice, we move along that spectrum. And if they don't understand, the teachings don't embrace us in any part of that spectrum, then they're not useful to us. And so they have to completely acknowledge and affirm our capacity to be anywhere along that spectrum. And they have to challenge us to manifest our real nature. In other words, they have to demand of us that we realize and fulfill what we can be as human beings, as Buddhas. And they have to give us a way to move forward in moments of our transgressions. In other words, they have to understand and embrace and guide us in the moments when we don't act out of our vows. I thought they also, very importantly, have to be something we can actually do. In other words, they can't be theoretical, something that is beautiful and profound to consider, but completely out of our grasp. They have to be something we can practice day to day. And can practice means they're realistic, not just theoretically, not for a fully realized being, but for you or me wherever we begin, wherever we find ourselves. And then finally, but not conclusively, by any means, so you can do this own thought experiment for yourself, I thought all of that could be true, and it's still not active because I haven't made a personal commitment. In other words, there's a beautiful meal all laid out on the table, but I'm not sitting down to eat. And so there has to be a personal commitment, a vow, to bring them into life. And so I was thinking about that in relationship to this morning and this mando and this the Metta Sutta and our practice at this time. And so I just wanted to sort of begin with that. Because I think those two elements, there are a lot of ways that's spoken about in Buddhism. One is in terms of the conventional teachings and the ultimate teachings, conventional reality and ultimate reality. That the Dharma has to be timeless, placeless, corruptionless, right? It can't be something that in any way can be subject to disintegration. And at the same time, it has to manifest in the place in which things are constantly changing, because that's where we live. And those have to be perfectly integrated, which is good, because that's actually the nature of reality, is that perfect integration. That's prajnaparamita. And so that can also be a way that we think about the Dharma and think about practice in our own way, in our own time and place and practice, that both of those are functioning. In a sense, we're really practicing to realize both of those aspects and then to bring them into harmony. Okay, so I just wanted to open it up and let as many as possible, and probably many will not get a chance because we just don't have enough time, but to ask a question or to make a comment about this teaching we just chanted, about your own practice at this time, anything that seems compelling today. Okay? Kyosho, why don't we start? And because we're going to alternate, so Kyosho will ask a question, then we'll take one hopefully from somebody at home. And while that's happening, somebody else can raise their hand and get the mic so we can kind of move seamlessly from one person to the next.
With respect to moral conduct, in our Zen training, we often receive corrections, and in an institutional sense and in a teaching sense, the basis of correction ultimately is the precepts, and then there's us, the people being trained, and all the students. And I think that a predominant feature in my own training experience, and I see other people wrestling with this too, is that we often feel like we're being shamed by the mommy-daddy element in our training environment. And we dress it up so that it looks really adult, and our complaints all sound really sophisticated, but it feels like we're being constantly punished in one way of looking at that, I mean. So my question relates to, it seems as though the precepts are helping guide us in our practice. And the direction is to become able to become silent and to receive the deeper connection of peaceful integration pointed to in the Metta Sutta. And so that does not resemble the state of mind, the agitated state of mind of constantly shopping for justifications about the mommy-daddy punishment trip, mental trip. So I think my question relates to, does it not seem that precepts are somewhat different than directions and corrections to behavior, and that somehow as part of that, and I don't know how to describe it, and that's why I'm asking about it, that we're being guided to a way to not, perhaps to see how our own pain, our own distance from something inside ourselves is actually being constantly triggered and constantly triggered and constantly triggered by breaking the precepts?
Well, I would say the precepts are very much present there in that moment of training on both sides. So the person who is offering instruction has been given the responsibility of doing that, and they are learning how to do that. And so they hold some relative role and some relative degree of power, right, to be the one giving the instruction. And so there, our training in that moment is to do that without arrogance, anger, you know, frustration. In other words, to just offer the instruction and to be able to do that free from those entanglements within ourselves. And that's a practice. And because it's a practice, it means it's not always being done perfectly, right? And so, and I think everyone who is in that role, whether it's you know, a meal crew leader, or, you know, somebody teaching about the timekeeper, or a monitor, or, you know, a senior, is learning how to hold that and their own feelings and emotions, which may be brought up out of insecurity or just what happens when they hold responsibility or whatever, and that that not flow into the interaction. And to the degree that it does, that's their responsibility, right? To take ownership of that and to mend it if need be. And then on the receiving end, it's to be receiving that in the mind of a student, and to, you know, both for both people to be trusting each other, to have respect for each other and to be trusting each other, and to be able to hear that instruction, you know, which means we may have to deal with our pride or our resistance or whatever might be coming up, or our self-criticism, you know, that we hear the instruction and guidance as a self-criticism. And so, and then navigating that and trying to see it clearly, well, what is actually going on, right, can be very difficult because we're a little bit entangled in it. The other person may be a little bit entangled too. And then there's a tangle that happens together. And that's part of training. It's live. You know, it's happening in the moment. And that's why it's so important that we have a basis of mutual respect and mutual trust, and that we're all accountable to each other, and that we, you know, if something untoward happens, we can speak to each other about it. We can go and speak to somebody else. In other words, it can be addressed. But at every point along the way, the precepts are there, and they are talking about our behavior. You know, they're not theoretical. They're talking about what am I saying? What am I doing? What am I thinking? And so they're really completely integrated. And the more we can recognize that, I think the more alive they will be for us. Sure.
Okay, so we have a question from Kevin, who asks, as we're being prompted to stay at home, how does this parallel to the practice of coming home? And he added, this feels so layered and raw right now. And also, what about folks who have no physical home? Where is home for them?
Well, you know, ultimately, whatever physical home we have, we will lose, whether it leaves us or we leave it. And so, and yet, we should all have a home, a physical home, and many people don't. And that's, that exists in our culture, and in many ways by design, is a reflection of the values of our culture in terms of what and who is important. That spiritual question of where do we find our home is really so much about what practice is about, that the Buddha left home. And so many of spiritual practitioners left home in a very real way, in a physical way. In a sense, we all have to leave home in seeking the Dharma, which means we have to leave the place where we're abiding, the place where we have tethered ourselves to and defined as my place of permanence, of security, of identity. And, you know, in a sense, nobody wants to do that because it's scary. And that's the place where we've made our home. And so what does that even mean to let go of that? And so practice is the actual experience of letting go of that moment by moment, thought by thought, clinging by clinging, and to let go of that home and not immediately turn around and purchase another one, but to actually to learn to be free and at ease within that boundlessness. The Buddha said that in order to do that, it is favorable to have favorable conditions, which means because that's going to be unsettling sort of naturally and inherently for anyone. The more conducive our environment can be, the more trusting and relaxed we will be, and the more we'll be able and willing to really let go at that level. And so that's why practice centers, sanghas, monasteries, a place to sit in your own home is helping to do that, is create a space where you can relax as much as you can and let go and do that self-examination. For people who don't live in such circumstances or at a time when no place feels safe, it's going to be more difficult. And I think it's just good to acknowledge that, right? I talked earlier in the week about how when there is stress or anxiety or a more pervasive sense of dis-ease in our time, in our culture, which there certainly is now, and I think for many there has been for the last 3 years, a very sort of ongoing, ceaseless, pervasive sense of disruption and instability. Being sentient beings, we're going to experience that, and we will think about it in our own ways. We might rationalize it in different ways. We will all respond to it, and we can respond in a host of different ways. We can become numb. We can rationalize it. We can get sort of intoxicated in the information of it. We can just be stressed and anxious. And so practice helps us to acknowledge that and really become intimate with that and understand it in many different ways. And in that way, calm the house that we live in. And so, you know, we always have the capacity within this path to take refuge within the Dharma in our practice and take up that work. At different times, it's going to be more or less challenging. And so in the best of times, it's, you know, the challenges are diminished, and in difficult times, those challenges rise up and become much stronger. And I think if we just recognize the time that we're in, whether it's just the time in our life or the time in a particular period that we're in or the time in our world, that can help us to understand what we're actually experiencing. So it's not just you. Right? It's not because sometimes we can just turn that against ourselves. And it's like, why is this happening to me? And we're not recognizing that we're in relationship, intimate relationship with everything around us. And the way we experience that is going to vary and not always identify itself. You know, the feelings we're experiencing don't say, tell us, you know, you are experiencing this anxiety because of this, this, and this. We just may experience a certain sensation in the body. Ken?
When chanting the Metta Sutta or the Four Immeasurables, sometimes I'm feeling it, oftentimes I'm not, or at least I'm not the way I want to be feeling it. You said during session that doing this is a practice, and I wonder, to expand on that, I notice that I can get self-critical which creates the opposite of what I should be generating, because I feel I should have more heart in it. And you said it was a practice. Could you expand upon that?
So the question was, and I hope I get this right, is that in chanting the Metta Sutta, and as it says, a wishing in gladness and in safety. So it's really speaking about a deep heartfelt wish, right? These are not just words that are being spoken, but with your whole being, you're bringing forth this wish, this deep, deep desire that in gladness and in safety, that every being is at ease. And so how do you bring that forth? Well, oftentimes, you know, in session or when the mind is more settled, we've been practicing well, or we're just feeling more calm, it's much easier to naturally experience that depth and that heart open and being filling us and being brought into those words so that it is a heartfelt expression. But sometimes we don't feel that. We don't experience it that way. And this can happen just in daily liturgy. And so it is a practice. And so tries to use the words as a grounding. So you're really entering into the words because the words have meaning. And so give yourself into the meaning of those words. And so you're not holding them up here in your mind. You're really letting the meaning of those words fill you. So you're making contact with what those words mean. And not in a, you know, sort of a responsive way, thinking about them, but just really, because you already know what they mean. That's the power of the language. And so you're really letting those words fill you to the best of your ability. And if your mind is distracted, you bring it back, just like you would to your Zazen practice. And if it feels shallow, it feels shallow. You chant shallow. If it's deep, then you chant deeply. And so you're not trying to force something to happen, to force a particular kind of experience. And that it's all valid, right? So that wish is it may be less, we might think of it as less powerful. It's going to affect you differently, depending on how it sits in you. But it's still a wish, even if it feels more shallow. And so it still is very worthwhile doing for you and all those that you're wishing that for. And then you just keep working at that, you know. But it's completely connected to your mind and your mindfulness and where you are in that moment and how the openness of your heart. But when you're practicing it every day, you can, that heart will continue to open. You can also center it here. You know, you can put your mind here in your heart. So that as you're chanting those words, it's coming from that place. This is one of the energy centers, the tantians. You know, we talk a lot about the hara, but this is also a center. And so we work with this as well. And even though there is a, you know, it is the heart organ that is, there's a reason why we connect that to emotions. There's a reason why we connect that to a deep, deep wish. That organ does actually respond to that. And so that's why we're focusing here, and it brings energy and attention to that place.
So I'm just going to project.
Yes.
Okay. There are quite a few questions about the line unburdened with duties,
mm-hmm.
and people expressing various views, expressing that they feel actually like they have a lot of duties or a lot of obligations to family, friends, loved ones, and how to work with and understand that teaching at this time.
So the question was about the line unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways. And this is what I was hoping we would actually do. I mean, all of this is good, but actually thinking about these lines and how are you relating to these right now? And so we too thought when all of this happened and we closed our doors and stopped having retreats that we were going to have all of this time to do all these different things. And that hasn't exactly been the case yet. We'll see how that works out in time. You know, I kind of think of orioki, the practice of orioki, that the formal meal. So the bowl itself is orioki, the right amount is what that means. And so the bowl is a container. You can't take more food than the bowl will hold. But each of us decides how much to put into that bowl. And so in a certain sense, sometimes the duties that we have are of our choosing, but not of our choosing as well. Sometimes we just need to be stepping up to more because that's what's being called for. And so as those duties increase or multiply, how do we continue to not be burdened by them? And so clearly that's something that is happening in our mind. And so if we see them as burdensome, if we are talking to ourselves and others about how burdensome then they are, then they will become, in fact, much more burdensome. Now, that doesn't mean just to deny what it is that we have to do, but it means to be very aware of the intimate relationship between mind, consciousness, language, inner and outer, and the reality that we're actually experiencing. And so think about the caretaking practice that we do every morning here. That the sutra that we're chanting is the Sutra of Great Compassion. So it's helping us to see that these duties that we're about to undertake are not just about accomplishing things which need to be done, but they're also a way for us to practice our meditation. They're a way for us to take care of each other. They're a way to manifest compassion in the world, to integrate all of that together within a moment of wondrous simplicity. And so how do we keep letting them be light and simple, even as we may be taking on more? And so it's a practice, for sure. And frugal, you know, if you think of what does frugal mean and what might be its relationship to how we undertake an activity. So to be frugal is to not be wasteful of things, of time, of resources, of tools, of materials, of our mind, of thoughts, of energy. And so when we're, you know, doing a lot of unnecessary narration, particularly if it's, you know, negative thinking, we could think of that as not being frugal, right? We're using really important energy that we need and that is needed, and we're sort of throwing it into very unconstructive and actually actively destructive ways. And so we could think of frugality there as well, you know, to be spare, to use just the right amount of thought, of action.
I can't remember the lines on the sutra, maybe I'll get to it, but I was wondering if you could give your definition of morality, and are we inherently moral beings? And if so, then why so much anger, ill will,
immorality,
destruction?
So Hojin says, ask, how would I define or speak of what is morality, and are we inherently moral beings? And if that's true for us, not just Buddhist practitioners, but everyone, why then is there so much immorality? Why is there so much creating of suffering in the world? And this is really an eternal question. It's a fundamentally spiritual, religious question that every religion has to respond to. And each does in its own way, from its own sort of understanding. I mean, I think of moral as being in harmony, being in accord, that it's not something that is imposed or superimposed upon, but it's really, it's being in accord with the real nature of things. And so nature itself, Mother Earth, I think is a perfect example of a moral being in a complex system in which things work in accord with their time and place, that each being inhabits its own Dharma state and sort of finds that balance within its own place. We, because of our consciousness, can imagine and create things that don't exist and bring them into existence on all levels. We can do things that arise out of our conceptual mind and do them with some understanding, but not fully understand what we're doing. We can create something or commit an action that has a certain amount of power and not actually know the power that it has. We can understand that there is cause and effect, and yet, and as well as not understanding that, but even in understanding it, we can commit an action that we don't know all of the consequences of that action. And so we're, in a sense, we've been released into this world with this immense power that is so much larger than we know. And we start using it right away. And so moral teachings are trying to help us understand the immutable laws that we live within, and so which are that sort of description of that harmony that exists within the world, so that we can take our natural place, our rightful place, as other creatures do. Because we can create worlds that defy that, that turn against that, that desecrate that, we need moral teachings. We need spiritual practices. We need each other. We need parameters. In a sense, the precepts create parameters, just like right now. This morning, we were talking about what are the parameters we're creating for ourselves who live here safely, both for ourselves and others. In other words, what are the parameters of our movement as we self-isolate? And so those parameters, those boundaries really help us to stay in accord, in tune with our inner and outer environment. We're going to go back to Sean here.
Okay.
So Yosha asks, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. But our work takes place in the world, so why does it end there?
So Yosha's asking about the end of the sutta. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. And so we can think of that as the Buddha, the pure-hearted one who has realized deep enlightenment, is free from all sense desires, and has now broken the cycle, is freed from the cycle of birth and death. So this is the classic or traditional understanding, that enlightenment frees us from the cycle of life and death, of rebirth, because there's no longer a grasping at existence, at identity, itself, at our desires, that being the driving force that keeps propelling us from one moment to the next, from one lifetime to the next. We could also understand that in terms of ourselves and our own moment-to-moment life, that when we don't hold to fixed views or fixed anything, when we realize all things are fundamentally liberated, abiding in their own Dharma state, as Dogen says in the Mountains and Rivers Sutra, our own heart is realized as pure. The question of whether we're inherently moral or inherently good, inherent in Buddhism means an intrinsic characteristic that exists in and of itself, a kind of permanent quality of something. And so in that sense, there is nothing inherent in the world, not in us or in anything. Everything arises out of a dependent relationship. And yet, because our biology, our being, inclines towards what is affirming of life, we want to live, and inclines away from what is destructive of life, we don't want to die, we have within us an inherent, not in the sense of independently existing, but in the sense of this sort of deep impulse or inclination towards what is positive and away from what is destructive. And so the pure-hearted one, or when we cease having fixed views, that is freed of all that tends to bind it, all of our sort of confused and upside-down ways of trying to gain happiness that actually just create more suffering. And that as our understanding, our vision becomes more and more clear, that is going hand in hand with being less and less subject to our feelings, our emotions, our desires. Those are becoming more clear. In other words, they're becoming less self-centered. They're becoming more magnanimous in the sense that what we want is we don't want just for ourselves. That if we want something, it's like, you know, the impulse when we get frightened and we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, and sort of this deep, deep fear of starvation, right? This sort of primitive, very primordial fear of not having enough. And so we go out and we take all the food and all the things off the shelf to make sure that we have enough, and we don't think, but what about the next person? What about all the other people who have the same fear? And we'll hunger in exactly the same way. What about them? And so when we get immersed within our own greed, for instance, our own fear, and our desire to have enough, we can lose sight, right? That clear vision gets lost. And we just want to make sure that we're taken care of. And so that's what we're trying to liberate, right? And so if we take less, and it means we have less, that's our choice. Right? That's the choice that we're making. We too will go hungry, right? As other people do, rather than, you know, ensuring that we have enough and other people will go hungry. That ceases to be a satisfaction of our desire. Our desire is that everyone has enough. And that may also be a practice. We may feel that impulse. We want to take more than we should. And we see that. and we try and practice that. And then in that way, we are not born again into that world that is bound to greed or is bound by our fear and insecurity. We open up our mind, we don't know, and we try to be more courageous.
Maybe this is, it touches on a number of the things you've just been talking about, but maybe the outwards and unbounded. I'm interested in this process as we're experiencing this coronavirus experience. How can we use this to not be neutral, firstly not fragment and become more distant, not physically, but you know, between even me and you. But how could we use it to get closer? And I am noticing in my own mind, and as I'm also reading the news and seeing my mind in that, you were saying that we create parameters here in order to live in. And I went back to, living in college. And, whose job is it to take the trash out? Well, it only seems like it's an issue for the person who wants it taken out more frequently. Everyone else below that, that's not an issue. And so, we saw those pictures of those college adults, choosing to act in a way that might not be within our internal parameters. And so it seems like, okay, I will be in harmony with you. If we just keep it to me and you, I will be in harmony with you very conditionally, actually, that whatever you behave in a way that meets my internal parameters, I'll be harmonious. And it's almost faux harmony in my mind, because it's requiring you to show up in a very specific way for me. Maybe you can take that from there.
Yeah. So Sekou asked the aspect about being unbounded, with a boundless heart, cherishing all living beings, and that how do we use this time when we're physically distancing ourselves and not become more distant from each other? And how, as I understood your question, when we see others acting in ways that seems reckless, seems not compassionate, seems dangerous to themselves and others, how do we maintain that boundless heart? How do we not create more distance between ourselves and them? And this is really very much what the sutra is pointing to. And it is the basis of that heartfelt wish. And so in a sense, being in isolation here and knowing about reading news stories about what is happening in other parts of the world in our country and seeing the ways in which different people are responding to this. So some people are ignoring it. I just read that there's a whole kind of anti thing going towards Dr. Fauci, who has, been a sort of a leading consultant of presidents for years about in, epidemics, and seems to be clearly just trying to help, and is being, excoriated by loyalists to the president who think that he's got a secret agenda to undermine Trump and, get him out of office. And so we see all of these different displays, people doing incredibly heroic things and very generous things, and other people being very dangerous and reckless and angry and acting out of that. And that really is the great challenge of every true spiritual practice, in the simplest form, is to love our enemies, is to keep our heart open and be able to see and not gloss over, not have an unrealistic or sort of even dangerous view that compassion means that I love everyone and ignore what they're doing, or am complacent in a moment when I could not be complacent and act. And so it does. I mean, it cannot mean that, right? Because that isn't compassion. That's delusion. It's foolishness. It's complacency. It's and so how do we, in a sense, the easy part is within our own minds, in using a sutra like this or chanting the four immeasurables, you know, to just work at keeping your heart open in the midst of this. So a way to work with that is, and this is a traditional practice, is that when you're chanting the four immeasurables, for instance, is that you bring to mind those people that you feel anger towards because of the way they're acting at this time, or that you're angry at because of how they're adding confusion, you know, to the situation when we need clarity, or they're adding ambivalence when we need decisiveness. And we hold them in our mind, and we may feel our own emotions rising up towards them, you know, of anger or irritation or even hatred. And that's what we're working with. That's why this is, the Buddha taught this. And so in that way, we're working to both acknowledge those strong emotions and to not be taken over by them, but in a way that's realistic. And that's really important, that we're not just trying to pass over the emotions we're feeling. We're acknowledging them, but we're also choosing to try and make our heart a little larger, even so that we can hold that anger and hold the desire to have compassion for them at the same time. Even if in this moment you don't, maybe all you feel is anger for them, but you don't want to stay there. And so you're trying to open your heart more largely, and you're trying to extend that wish for well-being to them, even in the moment where it may feel very shallow. But it's not false. We're not being hypocritical, because we're trying to do something, right? We're not pretending that something is true when it's not. We're acknowledging what is true, and we're stepping into that in a way that's very powerful. And what happens is, when you speak those words, your heart has to open just a little bit to let those words in, right? Otherwise, you won't be able to say them. And so even that, even if it feels minuscule, it will help. I mean, I've experienced this, you know, the discomfort sometimes of even saying those words, right? It's like you don't want to even give them that, right? But you do. And in that, something has to increase, expand a little bit. And then it's more difficult, you know, if we're, you know, in the company of or next to, or you're in a market and you're seeing something happen, you know, or you're a physician and you're seeing the way people are responding, you know, then of course it's going to be much more difficult. And so that's why it's good to practice in these environments where it's difficult but simpler, right? Because there we're developing our capacity. If we can't do it there, it's not likely that we're going to be able to do it when it's alive. And so that's why these practices are really important to do internally. Sean?
Okay, so Eiko asks, what advice do you have to console people who are facing death and sickness? My family had a virus scare last night. I told them I loved them. A friend in Italy asked, what do the nuns and monks say now?
Mm-hmm. That's a really good question. You know, I think each of us in that moment needs to speak truthfully. That, you know, at a time like that, it might be helpful to share something you know or you have heard or read in a sutra. I think, you know, who we're talking to is very important. So if you're talking to a Buddhist practitioner, if you're talking to somebody who's Christian, if you're talking to an atheist, that matters, because, you know, where we are, what we have cultivated in our lives brings with it certain language and certain teachings and practices that can have incredible meaning for each person, given their respective background. And so, I mean, that's what chaplains do. You know, they don't bring in a faith. They meet the person in their own faith. And even just as lay people, as friends, you know. So it might be to turn it around and ask them, you know, if they're a person of faith, what in your faith do you find strength in? What do you take refuge in? What teaching? Maybe you could read that together. Or if it's a song, you could sing it together. That might help. So that you're really meeting them where they are. But I think too, you know, what's most powerful is what's authentic. Is what's authentic. And so my suggestion would be to, if, you know, if you are their friend, if you are a family member, if you are just an acquaintance with them, to the thing that we share is our humanity. The thing that we share is that we're all mortal beings. We're all going to die. And that we are, we all want well-being. And to meet there. And so if that person is afraid, we know fear. You know fear. And so meet them in that fear. Understand that fear. You may also, if you have calmness, bring them that. Offer them that. You know, just in your being. But I think to try and, you know, just be genuine. And even in your uncertainty about how the best way to respond to, that's authentic. You know. I mean, in other words, we don't have to be an expert or a professional in meeting a person in a moment of great vulnerability. I think the best thing we can do is be in your own seat. You know, so if you're in a seat of stability, use that seat. If you're in a seat of mindfulness, use that mindfulness. If you know how to be vulnerable with them. And I think that then can be incredibly powerful medicine. Robbie.
So there's this line, where is it? One should sustain this recollection. And so I take that to mean pretty much 24/7. And I think, as you said, during your talk during Sesshin, like, there was a time when you thought, like, this is just impossible, which I guess is how I feel. And when I think about loving kindness, it's really something that I bring forth in times of need when I feel very much lacking. But it's my sense that that it's something that really should be brought forth continuously. And I'm wondering if this is something that, I don't know, how to hold that mind. Yeah.
So the question is mind of loving kindness and compassion. And the line in the sutra that says, free from drowsiness, we should sustain this recollection, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down. These are the four postures of practice. And so how do we do this? So in Sesshin, that really is very, very deliberately and decisively the practice. And we're in silence and we set things up to make that a more conducive environment in which to do that. And that is one of the most challenging things of practice because our mind slips in and out. It gets distracted. We forget. We return. We forget. We return. But what the sutra is saying is, you know, it may seem impossible, as I spoke about the other day. In my early training, it just seemed impossible. And so on the one hand, you know, don't bind yourself by thinking in terms of absolutes. Hear it as an aspiration towards what our mind is fundamentally capable of and that we have to practice into. And so, you know, so for instance, if the Buddha said, free from drowsiness, now and then sustain this recollection, you know, or the best that you can, or, you know, I mean, then that would already sort of set us up to, I think, go about it in a half-hearted way. So being presented with this, what may seem like a too large intention or capacity that may seem larger than our capacity, but it's there. And we hear it again and again. And I think, I really believe the purpose of that is to challenge us to keep aspiring, not towards grasping at some absolute, but just to keep not having a fixed view and thinking that this degree of mindfulness or constancy is all I can do, and that's my sort of lot, right? That we're always sort of practicing into letting go of fixedness and realizing our capacity is larger and larger. And I think of that as being so relevant now in terms of sustaining, being steady, in a sense being vigilant within our own practice, to continually be cultivating compassion, which means particularly in the moments when it's not present, cultivating loving kindness, particularly in the moments where it's absent, cultivating our mindfulness, particularly when it's dropped away, that's how we sustain. And that we can do, right? That we can do. So maybe one more as we're coming close to her. I know.
There's a lot of great questions.
I know. Well, maybe we'll just have to continue this over some more days.
Meju asks, is it possible for me to offer peace and calm when I'm not feeling peaceful and calm and wise and skillful myself? What about offering the truth of my anxiety and disorientation? And how do I do that without giving fear?
That's a good question, because, you know, to be authentic means when we are anxious, then that is our actual experience. It's not who we are, it's not a fixed thing, but it may be a predominant sensation or emotion in the moment. And so to try and cover that up is not going to serve well. And so that's where we just, you know, we do the best we can. And who are we in the presence of? Who are we working with? Who needs our help? How can we serve in that moment? So that may have something to do with it. So if we need to respond and that's what we have to respond with, you do your best. If somebody really needs something that we can't offer in the moment, can we come back in another moment? There's nothing ingenuine about that, I think. This is live all the time. And, you know, practice is not about fulfilling an idea of something. That's how we get ourselves into a whole mess of trouble, is by thinking that, you know, is hearing this not as teachings and guidance and aspiration, but as a mandate. You must be. That's not real, right? That's sort of just a different version of what we do in our deluded states. We impose ideas and ways of being and expectations and identities that we think we have to fulfill. At the same time, there are times where we are called by people in need, and they do need something from us. We may be anxious, and they do not need anxiety. They need something else. And if we are called and we need to respond, then we need to do the best we can to dig deep and bring forth whatever measure of calm we can muster. Right? Because we know that if we're just open and forthright and honest about our anxiety, now we just have two anxious people. Right? Sometimes that may be exactly the right medicine, but other times it's not. And so we do have the capacity to experience, and this requires a certain amount of emotion, of wherewithal, presence of mind, but we do have the capacity to be very aware of what we're feeling and put it aside and redirect our attention to what needs to be made manifest right now. I mean, people do that all the time. Not people who don't practice do that. You know, when the baby cries and you are not in the right state of mind to respond to that baby, but she's crying, right? When somebody is in distress, when somebody is wounded, right? And you're preoccupied with fear or something else, but that person needs our attention. We do have that capacity. It's inherent. It's built into us. And so it's not necessarily the way we, you know, the strategy we want to be using at all times. But I mean, in a sense, that's what it means to be in a role as a friend, as a parent, as a teacher, as a senior, as a therapist, as a guide, is sometimes we need to rise up and dig deep and bring forth what we do actually have. It's just not easily accessible because something else is very present within us. And to try and find and do that, to do that in a way that is authentic, because we're seeing what's happening, right? We're not pretending. So, I mean, I imagine that there are, you know, I just think of the nurses and the doctors and who are overcome every day with anxiety and fear and exhaustion, and are responding, just keep responding. And of course, that is not a sustainable place for a long time. There will be a cost for that. There is a cost to that, right? As there is when we do that in our much more humble ways. But sometimes that's the cost we take on. Sometimes that's what serving means, is you take on a certain amount of harm, right, in order to help somebody else. And, you know, to try and do that in a way that is as smart and as careful and as wise and skillful as possible. We're not talking about being, you know, a reckless bodhisattva. You know, that's not it. But serving does demand of us. You know, if you think about all the ways in which just practicing is constantly demanding each of us to keep stepping forward, keep stepping forward, keep showing up, keep starting over. That isn't just so we can take care of ourselves. It's really so that we can, in moments when we are called, step forward. So I'd like to end with the Four Immeasurables, and I, you know, encourage us to work with this teaching by holding all the many people, the beings, you know. And so I think of all of the people, the healthcare workers, you know, and those of you in our Sangha who are doing this, and who are doing that from different places, you know, because that's another thing. Having, you know, there's so many different ways to serve. And sometimes we serve with the skills that we have, and sometimes we use other skills. Sometimes we use those skills in this moment, and sometimes this is not the moment to use those skills. We have to make our own decisions about that. But to really, you know, that's a way we can practice are giving our loving kindness to people that are serving right now. And so we can bring to mind all the people who are working with people right now who are sick. We can bring to mind those who are sick, those who are dying, those who have died, and just all the people who are afraid, right? Which might include you, you yourself. Just holding the world, you know, to look at these maps and see these circles representing clusters of people, individuals, people, actual people, each one with a name, each one having a life, right? They're not just statistics, they're not numbers. And to see that reaching across the world, it's horrifying. And it is also such a vivid demonstration of a manifestation of our one world. It's the only one we've got. And so, you know, too, as Sekou said, how do we use this time in which it would be so easy to come apart to come together? And in that way, to really be manifesting not just our practice, but our basic nature. And that's how even within such a time, there can be joy and comfort and closeness when we radiate that kindness over the entire world. So thank you, everyone. I knew we wouldn't be able to hear from everybody, but I hope this is helpful. And maybe we'll want to continue. This is a good way of just connecting and hearing, giving everyone who's not here and people who are here a way to speak and be heard, and maybe let the voices we've heard today represent all of us. And so we'll keep looking at ways to do this. Okay, so Jiru is going to lead us in the four measurables. And so we'll finish with that. So please, everyone, take care of yourselves, and let's genuinely wish and live in a way that is, to the best of our ability, helping to take care of everyone at this time. Okay, so take care of your practice, take care of your health, and we will continue to meet each other in this way.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as cushions, incense, liturgical instruments, Dharma books, and more, visit monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.